You're listening to a podcast from the Employment, Pensions and Benefits team at McLean Murray & Spence. I'm Christine Jardine. Joining us now is Chris Phillips, who's a partner in the employment team, and he's going to be looking at the problems of managing absence in the workplace. One of the issues, of course, is the difference between sickness absence and absenteeism. Chris, could you explain a wee bit about that to us, please?
It is an important distinction that needs to be made, and it's a trap that many employers often fall into. It's really vital to understand the differences between absence on the one hand, which is a genuine issue, something that's based on somebody's ill health, it means that they can't get to their work for whatever reason, and absenteeism, which is usually referred to as throwing a sickie, being off without a good reason, basically. On the one hand, genuine absence that's due to ill health needs to be handled in a very particular way. Absenteeism, on the other hand, is more what we would call a conduct issue and needs to be handled quite differently.
What are the problems that can come up if an employer treats something as absenteeism when it is actually genuine absence? They get it wrong.
It can cause real problems in the employment relationship. Clearly, an employee feels that they are being mistrusted. They can become very defensive, very uncommunicative, and it can make for a very difficult absence management situation. In worst-case scenario, they can feel they've no alternative but to raise a grievance against their employer or perhaps even resign if it's treated very inappropriately. Of course, one further thing that an employer can always do is conduct a return to work interview, and that can be useful both in the situation of genuine absence, because it demonstrates to the employee that you're being supportive and interested and keen to understand why they've been off and how you can support them. But in the case of absenteeism, it also reminds the employee gently that you are on their case, that you are monitoring their levels of absence, and that they cannot be frivolous in the way that they take time off work. You will always want to speak to them and try and get to the bottom of things when they do come back.
Assuming someone's absence is genuine, is it difficult for employers or is it important for employers to be able to identify when someone should actually be classed as disabled?
It's vitally important, and it's something which can often be quite challenging for employers, particularly where a disability is not perhaps an obvious one. For example, if somebody is challenged by their mental health or has a condition which is asymptomatic, it's not actually showing any outward symptoms, that can be very difficult for an employer because they simply don't realise that the person is in fact disabled and as a consequence covered by the Disability Discrimination Act. Someone who's covered by that act is afforded very, very specific protection, and if an employer gets it wrong by discriminating against an employee unlawfully, by failing to make adjustments to their working arrangements or perhaps to look at adjustments to the physical environment in which they work, they can face very severe penalties through the employment tribunal system.
What steps should employers be taking then to make sure that they better manage absence and absenteeism?
Communicate well with your employees, keep in touch with them, understand the nature of why they're absent, make sure that they're absolutely clear about that. If they feel that there's lots of short-term intermittent absences that are not adequately explained, then they can go down the conduct route, the absenteeism route. But if, on the other hand, it seems to them that it is genuine absence, they need to speak to the employee, they need to obtain appropriate medical advice. And if the condition looks as if it's longer term or perhaps rooted in a more serious illness, then they need to be mindful of their obligations under the Disability Discrimination Act. Again, consult with the employee, perhaps take further expert advice from an occupational health specialist, and look at making adjustments to the working environment and to the working arrangements.
Thank you very much, Chris. In the modern workplace, one of the main issues to be dealt with is, of course, stress. That's an issue we'll be looking at specifically in a later podcast. You're listening to a podcast from the McLean, Murray & Spence Employment, Pension and Benefits team. It's been 10 years in the making, but will the new corporate killing law make any real difference? I'm joined now by David Leckie, a partner in McLean Murray & Spence who deals with health and safety, and independent safety expert Tony Cox. David, what exactly will this new law mean?
The new law creates a new offence for corporations where there has been a fatality and it can be proved that that fatality arose as a result of a gross breach of a duty of care. and the way in which the company's activities were managed by its senior managers was a substantial element of that breach. Where that can be established, then the company will be guilty of corporate manslaughter.
One of the things which the people who originally were campaigning for this law wanted was to see individuals in the dock. Now, that's not going to happen, is it?
That has not happened. This does not apply to individuals. Having said that, the actions of senior management will be very much at the forefront of a prosecution case, because the prosecution will be focusing on what did the senior management actually do to prevent this fatality happening. So although senior managers, directors, officers, etc. will not be in the dock, they will very much be under the microscope.
What will the penalties be like? Will they be really harsh penalties, or will they be penalties which perhaps might be regarded as mild for major international companies?
Well, the penalties are actually identical to the existing penalties under the Health and Safety at Work Act, namely an unlimited fine. The fines will be higher than the fines that we see at the moment for health and safety. One of the other innovations in the Act is that it is open to the court to impose a publicity order on a company if convicted of this offence, which would mean that they would have to publicise the conviction, the details of the conviction, in a newspaper or other similar publication.
Turning to you now, Tony, what will be the practical difference that this law will make to the working environment?
Well, if we're speaking of a company that had already been doing a sterling job of meeting its health and safety duties under the Health and Safety at Work Act, in theory, they shouldn't have to do anything different, because the standard of performance that's called for is actually the same. What it does do is it greatly increases the penalties if something does go wrong and there is a fatality in the working place. And that should concentrate the minds of senior managers on the way their health and safety management system is actually working.
Is there a set of actual practical steps they will have to take, though?
So a lot of companies have got very good procedures, but they don't implement them thoroughly. And this would cause them, I think, to look again at that and make sure they're doing what they think they're doing.
David Leckie?
Well, I think employers must take this opportunity at this stage to conduct a thorough audit of all of their safety management systems, particularly risk assessments. They've got to look very, very carefully at their compliance with health and safety guidance and very carefully at their safety culture. A key element of this legislation is that safety culture should be at the forefront of any organisation's attitude to addressing this whole issue of safety management.
David Leckie, Tony Cox, thank you very much. For more information on these and other subjects, visit mms.co.uk.